on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, good evening. Another week has passed and this is the 105 Sports Special here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Thanks very much for tuning in as we round up the latest local sports news. On today's show, I'll be chatting to Cambridge City Vice Chairman Terry Dunn about the latest update on their new stadium project in Sawston. The proposed move has taken a positive step forward this week. Well, a number of high-profile sporting events have been cancelled so far this year, none other than the 2020 boat race. However, John Willis organised a virtual race which took place on the weekend between the Light and the Dark Blues, yes, Cambridge and Oxford. The event was also set up to raise money for his charity Power to Inspire, which focuses on inclusion in sport for all. Find out who won the race later on in the show. And last week, St Ives Town announced they had appointed a new first team assistant manager. Mitch Austin, former Kettering Town assistant, is the new man in the dugout. He joins me alongside manager Ricky Mahinicky to discuss the appointment. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can do at 105 Sport on Twitter and Facebook, the best place to do so. My name is Ollie Slack. Thanks very much for tuning in. Now, before we do anything else tonight, football fans amongst you will be aware it is the return of the Premier League this evening as Aston Villa take on Sheffield United at Villa Park. Sky News reporter Joe Rawson is covering the game this evening and I caught up with him earlier on ahead of the tie. So, Joe, 100 days since the last Premier League match. It must feel like a long time coming for you.
Oh, yeah, 100 days. It's been a long 100 days, not just for us who work in the football industry, but for football fans. Obviously, it was the right decision since lockdown and the right decision made by the Premier League. And obviously, it was forced upon them in the end by the government to suspend fixtures. But I think it also feels like the right time for it to come back. Lockdown measures have started to ease. Shops have started to open. And there is a sense that we're getting back to some sort of normality. And football is back, but not as we know it, because there are no fans allowed in stadiums. So it's going to be very different. Obviously, the health and safety protocols around every match are also going to make things look a lot different. Players are going to have to social distance when warming up, when sat on substitute benches. They're not allowed to celebrate with each other anymore. In fact, they'll instead go towards a celebration camera so they can celebrate into that and have a connection with supporters watching on TV from home. So it's all going to be a little bit weird and very different to the normal, but I'm looking forward to it being back.
And you forget, don't you, because of the break, there's still places to decide in the Premier League. European spots up for grabs. There's relegation to be avoided as well. And for Aston Villa and Sheffield United, it's pretty much exactly what both of those will be doing. Remind us what they're both playing for this campaign.
Yeah, I mean, for Aston Villa, this is their game in hand. They made the League Cup final earlier on in the season. And this is a fixture that if they win, they will move out of the bottom three. They're currently 19th in the table on 25 points. Watford are 17th on 27 points. They could actually go ahead of West Ham, who are 16th, if they can get the 3 points against Sheffield United. The Blades are looking up the table rather than over their shoulders. They are in with a real possibility of nicking a European spot. Who'd have thought that when they were promoted from the Championship at the end of the last campaign? But a victory will take them above Manchester United and Wolves into fifth. They'll be just 2 points behind Chelsea in fourth, and they'll have played the same games as the teams around them. So, huge game for both clubs who were Championship sides last season, which is crazy when you think of where Sheffield United are on the table.
Yeah, remarkable to see the progress of both sides in different directions. There's been some rule changes though as well, isn't there, that's exclusively come into this end of the season in light of COVID-19. What are they and how will they affect the players?
Yeah, I mean, the big rule change is the fact that managers can make 5 substitutes now. Rather than 3, and there's going to be 9 players named on the bench rather than the usual 7. So that can have a big effect on games, because if a manager is making 5 changes, that is, of course, half of the team if you take away the goalkeeper. So the team that starts the match is going to be totally different to the side that finishes the match, and we'll not see any handshakes, for instance, before the game or after the game. Both teams won't walk out onto the pitch from the tunnel at the same time. That'll be staggered. Balls will be on cones around the pitch instead of ball boys, and they'll be sprayed with disinfectant every time they go out of play. And people will be wearing masks in the stadium, which seems to be the new norm now. We have to wear masks in a lot of our activities in everyday life, and football is no exception.
And the biggest difference when we switch on, whether it be the radio or the TV tonight, is going to be the lack of noise, or genuine noise, should I say, with no fans in the stadium. What's it going to be like for you, Joe? What's it going to be like for the players? How are they going to be dealing with this, and how challenging will it be?
Well, it's going to be very odd. If I start with myself, we're going to be able to hear the players and the managers, which is something that we're not usually able to do. And, you know, if, for instance, Dean Smith or Chris Wilder tonight get frustrated with a particular player, we're going to hear every word that is said. In terms of the players on the pitch, well, they're not going to have the boost that is given to them by tonight at Villa, for instance. The Holton can be such a key player for Aston Villa during home matches. If the Holton gets rocking, then it can really boost Aston Villa's performance, and they're going to be without that. Home advantage, I think, will be lost a little bit because of that, because the home fans aren't going to be there to roar their teams on. Players are going to have to watch what they say. You know, everything that they say is going to be broadcast, so I'm sure they'll have been told to watch their language. And it's going to be different for us watching it from home as supporters as well, because, you know, part of the football experience, it is having that crowd noise there and those visual effects of the crowd standing up and roaring players on at a corner. And that's going to be very different. Clubs have come up with different innovations. There's going to be cardboard cutouts of supporters at some grounds. There's banners at others. Clubs with TV screens will have fans live on their TV screens in the ground. So I'm sure we'll get plenty of shots of them on the television. And if you are watching it on the TV, you can choose to have FIFA sound effects, crowd effects on the game. So you can choose whether you want to listen to it as it would be a natural sound with no crowd there, or you can have fake crowd noises. So it's going to be odd. But I'm sure we'll get used to it after the first couple of games. And I'm excited to see what it will all look like this evening.
Joe Rawson there, who is at Villa Park this evening. Now let's turn our attention to local sport, though, and Cambridge City. Well, it's been a big week for them as their stadium project in Sawston moves ever closer. It's taken a big positive step forward this week. Joining me now to discuss that step forward is Vice Chairman Terry Dunn. Terry, thanks very much for coming on the show.
No problem, Ollie.
Firstly, how are you? How have you been over the last couple of months?
I've been very well, thank you. Yeah, we've been very fortunate here, and no problems whatsoever. So it's been good.
Good to hear. And some positive news as well on the Cambridge City front as well, with regards to the new stadium, the Sawston project. We saw the press release the other day. What is the latest on the new stadium?
Well, things have gathered pace just recently, Ollie, and we're now reaching the situation where hopefully we can announce what contractors we're going to take on board, and hopefully as well we can have the lease signed in the next few weeks as well. And the lease is a 99-year one, so thanks to the Satchel family, and that secures our future. So if we can get that signed, it'll be a great moment for the club as well. I'm a bit loath to put sort of dates on anything at the moment, but there's so many setbacks in the past. But yeah, things have moved on, and hopefully we can get contractors signed up shortly.
I guess that is the thing, is it? Because there's been a sort of a few false dawns. You don't want to release the date to the public, and then people expect that to happen, and then if things go wrong. But it definitely seems like the positive steps are, you know, going in the right direction this time, and further down the line potentially than other plans have been in the past. And that has become clear because of the press release. One of the quotes in there saying negotiations between suppliers and grant providers have reached advanced stages. So it does feel like things are sort of moving past the stage where potentially things may have fallen foul before.
That's correct, Ollie, yeah. And we're fortunate because some months ago we took on Pat McGowan to help out with grants, and his role has really moved on from that somewhat as well. So, and Kevin, my chairman, and I have been working closely alongside him. So he's certainly putting the hours in, and it looks now as though we're all agreed on quite a few aspects of it as well. And we're reaching the point where we can hopefully name contractors shortly and then move on from there. You know, so it'd be great for supporters to actually see some work going on there, because they are obviously getting very frustrated about it all, and they can see nothing's happening. So if we could actually show them something is happening, then that would be quite a boost to them as well.
It certainly would, especially in times like this as well. I just want to cross the T's and dot the I's on a couple of things that I spoke with Kevin about, the chairman, back in April, and see how things have developed since then. So with regards to Pat McGowan, he was brought in to try and deliver that extra funding. There was around about a 25% shortfall at the time. Is that all been secured now? That 25% shortfall's gone and the funding's there?
Well, we don't know as yet, because we're putting together the Football Foundation application. And there's also another grant, the Football Stadium Improvement Fund grant, and we know we can get $150,000 from that, because that's the maximum allowed at our level of non-league football. So, but we are hoping for big things with the Football Foundation grant. We don't know how much yet, because the application hasn't gone in, but it does look promising. We tick all the right boxes. We've got about 18 teams ourselves. We're going to be using the 3G pitch. And also the response from the neighbouring teams in Salston and around that area has been phenomenal. And they all can't wait to use the facility as well. So I think we're probably looking at, including their own, up to about 40 teams who want to use the 3G facilities for training every week. So. And as I say, that ticks a big box for the Football Foundation as well, you know. So hopefully, you know, that will go a long way to securing the deficit that Kevin mentioned.
Well, hopefully so. And we'll come on to the community impacts a little bit later on. There's also talk, Kevin, at the time on the interview back in April about they haven't actually finalised who will be undertaking the construction of the stadium yet. Do you have again, like we said, difficult to put dates on things, but do you have a timescale of when you'll be able to potentially announce that?
Well, no, I haven't really. I'm a bit loath to say anything about timeline, but hopefully in the next 3 months we can see some work going on. And the idea is to build a main stand, seated stand, about 450, and then opposite that, covered terracing, to hold about the same number of people. And the thing as well with it all is it enables us to expand somewhat as well, because there's loads of room there, so we can in the future, we want to, we can expand on the far side, we can expand behind both goals. So that should look, you know, quite positive, really. You know, it's all done with a view to looking to the future.
Mm. And you mentioned the 450-seated stand. It's a total capacity of 3,100 as well. Kevin mentioned there was potential to try and cut a few costs from the builders, etc., to try and allow a little bit of a buffer, just in case he wanted that buffer. Did that affect the final plans at all in cutting costs, whether it be that 3,000 plus capacity or 450-seated stand? Was any of that altered at all, the plans, because of the cutting of costs?
The idea originally was that the main stand would hold over just over 600. So, yes, it has been reduced somewhat. And I think as well, the original plan showed a lot of covered concrete terracing around the ground, and that's had to be reduced, really. So at the moment, we just got, you know, one lot of covered terracing on the far side. But the total capacity of it all will be around about 3,900, which we said we'd do from the outset. So and that meets the ground grading requirements of a grade B level 2 in non-league football. So should we go up two steps, then the ground's already, you know, ready to be used for that level.
Mm. And I guess a key thing as well is that it shows the ambition just in the stadium plans, really, of where the club want to get to as well, which must be great for supporters to look at. And supporters will be keen to try and find out, Terry, what is next. They'll want to know, really, how long before that first spade goes in the ground, so to speak.
Well, we're hoping that in a few weeks' time, some enabling work will take place. And by that, I mean being able to clear all the rubbish off the areas of the two pitches and the community land as well. I mustn't forget that. So that's what you call enabling work and clearing all the debris off and getting the levels right as well. So that would be the first thing to be done. I can't put a date on when you actually see something being built, but obviously the enabling work is very important. You have to have that in place first, and hopefully we may be able to see that in action in a few weeks' time, a few months even.
Mm. And in terms of the long-term timescale, it says that the project team have been working with the various contractors on the timescales, etc. Kevin mentioned back in April he'll want to try and get into the stadium playing by the 2021-2022 season. And of course, all this is slightly difficult to tell at the minute because of the situation with the virus, and no one knows really when football in the local leagues or City will get back playing. But it's still the ambition to get playing football in the stadium in the season 21-22?
Yeah, that's correct, Ollie. Yeah, that's the date we're looking at. But, who knows what's going to happen. I mean, we don't even know yet when next season's likely to start. It could be just half the season where you play each other once, in which case you're probably looking at Christmas, January start, and I really don't know. And how that has a knock-on effect for the following season, I don't know. But, yeah, it's fair to say we're looking at 21-22 at the start of the season, yeah.
Well, we will wait and see with bated breath with regards to the new season, because we're certainly keen to get some football back in the local area. With regards to a few of the nostalgic elements of the ground, there's a nod to Milton Road with the shed. Just for those who don't know, explain what it is and how it's going to be included in the new designs.
Yeah, the shed was a small covered terrace in opposite the main stand at Milton Road. It was hugely popular with supporters. It created a fantastic atmosphere. So we thought we'd reintroduce that and also position it opposite the main stand as well, and perhaps put a sign up to say something like the new shed, and I'm sure fans will absolutely love that, because it was a big feature at the old ground at Milton Road. So yeah, I would say that's with all confidence that's a definite, that is.
And what sort of generation of fans will remember the days in the shed then, Terry?
Well, we've seen a lot of youngsters, appear from time to time, so they certainly wouldn't know anything about it, But there's quite a few supporters left who would have fond memories of the shed, So, it brings back good memories to a lot of people.
Well, I look forward to seeing it erected when the stadium eventually gets put in place. There's already been a number of inquiries as well regarding the possibility to hire the artificial pitch and the facilities at the ground. I guess that shows here really what a positive impact this stadium could have on the local community.
Yeah, we knew in advance that there's a shortage of 3G pitches in the area. So, this is available until 10 o'clock at night, 7 days a week. So, including daytime hire, of course, as well. And certainly the response we've had from most local teams around the Sawston areas has been fantastic. All the Sawston teams especially are interested in it. So I think it will be a huge success, and there's always refreshment facilities available in the main clubhouse anyway. So that's an added bonus for it.
And lastly, Terry, I guess when you talk about community aspect, and it's almost like a throwaway comment in these sort of designs, because it's a little bit of a tick box exercise to get certain things or to put the plans through into that community. But really, how important is that? Because you're moving to a new area in Sawston where potentially you might be attracting a new audience as well, a new fan base. The men's team, the ladies team will be using that grass pitch, but to get the community involved in the facilities, just how really important is that?
It's absolutely vital, and certainly the response we've had from the community has already been very good. Our supporters' trust have actually been attending school fates, village fates in Sawston now for two or three years or even more. So the link is already there. It's not only the 3G as well. We've got a lot of function rooms available for hire as well, and I know it's been interest already from a dance school. So, you know, it's a two-story building that we can let out. So there's loads of room for that as well, you know, and so apart from the 3G. But yes, the community side of it is mixing in with the community, visiting local schools for football, coaching, etc., and getting schools in to visit the ground as well, you know, during the day. It's essential, really. It's a community thing, really, yeah.
Mm. It absolutely is. And if anything, it gives you a chance to practice your dance skills as well, Terry.
Yeah, I'm all for that, you know. I've just got to get me pacemaker right, Ollie, and, you know, away we go.
I look forward to that and, of course, the new stadium. Terry, thanks very much for chatting to us. Glad you're well, and we'll speak again soon.
No problem, Ollie. It's a pleasure. Thanks. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Sport on Cambridge 105 Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to the 105 Sports Special here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Thanks very much for tuning in. Up next here, let's talk about the boat race. And as I said earlier, the 2020 boat race has been cancelled, but John Willis has done as much as he can to get the next best thing by organising a virtual boat race, which took place on the weekend. It's all to raise money for Power to Inspire, a charity which focuses on inclusion in sport for all. I'm delighted to say John joins me now. John, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Ollie. It's great to be on.
How are you? You well? It's been a couple of months now, just over probably of lockdown. How's it been for you?
Actually, I've been very, very lucky. My daughters came home and I've been looked after and spoilt. My wife keeps on telling me I've got three women running around after me. So I'm very lucky. We've got a nice garden, so I've been able to get out. Yes, it's been very, very disappointing that Power to Inspire can't do the activities we normally do and go into schools and go into universities and so on. But we've been able to do other things instead.
Well, one of those other things you've been doing, and you said to me off air, it's been pretty occupying of your time of late, is the virtual MCH London Boat Race. Tell us about it, how you came up with the idea and some of the things involved in getting the process and the event on.
It's been a four-year journey, but a four-week sprint at the end. Four-year journey, I came up with the idea because I was a cox at Cambridge University, and when I set up Power to Inspire, we do inclusive sports festivals, and I've always felt that rowing could be so much more inclusive than it is. And rowing on an ergometer, which is a rowing machine to you and me, it actually makes it very accessible to disabled people. And we do, that's what we do. We do inclusion through sport. We get disabled, non-disabled, everybody to do sport together in the broadest sense of inclusion. So I've always wanted to do an inclusive rowing festival. I wanted to do it through an Oxford-Cambridge race. We've had a few false starts, but actually, rather strangely, lockdown offered us a really good opportunity in that a number of the top rowers from Oxford and Cambridge weren't able to compete. And when we reached out, they said, yes, they were very, very excited and interested in doing a virtual race. So that's how it was born. We got involved with MCH London, Ginger May, Give As You Live and Small Films, who have come and given a lot of time and energy and money to be involved in the project because they're supporting the charity. And without the team, we wouldn't have been able to make it happen. But my original idea of a relay race between guys and girls from Oxford and Cambridge had to be changed somewhat. So in fact, the race itself was all eight rowing against all eight at the same time.
And that then created an effect where you were able to effectively do the 4 mile course across the Thames in about 3 minutes.
Exactly. So all eight rowers, and there are four men and four women in each crew, and there are two disabled or disabled related athletes in both crews, had to row on their ergs, their rowing machines, for 3.5 minutes to ensure that the combined score, we took the power output from each rower, added them together to propel a virtual boat along a virtual river, which you can see marvellously on the screen. Small Films have done a marvellous job of animating it. And the idea was that that combined school would propel the boat to the finish, which is 4.2 miles or 6.8 kilometres. And they've actually even recreated a course which looks like the boat race course on the Thames.
Brilliant. So it sounds like a brilliant event, and glad it went really well. We'll come on to how people can watch it a bit later on. Just take us back to, though, when you founded Power to Inspire, because this is a charity which focuses on inclusion through sport. So just take us back to the time when you set this charity up and why you did so.
I was persuaded by a friend of mine. It took him many, many months, years, to actually get me to do an inclusive, an able-bodied triathlon relay. He did the bike leg, and he got a friend in to do the running leg. I did the swimming leg, and it showed to me that we could actually enjoy sport doing between able-bodied and disabled people doing sport together. I raised quite a bit of money. We set up the charity to improve inclusion through sport and champion it. And I did some other ridiculous fundraising challenges. I did 51,000 meter swims in 50 different pools in 100 days. I did all 34 Olympic and Paralympic sports in the run up to the Rio Games. And that has allowed me to go into schools and universities and the community to actually promote sport for everyone. So if you were put off sport as a young person, we can find a sport that you can do and enjoy. Lots and lots of people are amazed at the variety of sports that we teach, and that there is something out there for everybody. Two mantras that we have. One is from our very first Powerhouse Games. One young lad stood up and said, "Your rule number one should be to have fun, because that's what I had today." So that's our rule. Number one rule is everybody's to have fun. And the second one is no one should be left on the bench. Because when I was little, I was quite often left on the bench because I was born without fully formed arms and legs, and therefore were considered not very good at football and so on. And there were other games I couldn't play. But that's why we're doing it. And we've been very successful. We've done over 100 Powerhouse Games around the county and beyond. And we go into schools and teach and so on. It's great fun.
And has that sort of exclusion as a child really driven your passion and ignited it over the years, John, to keep the charity going and do so much great work for it?
It has, but also I realised that if you have a disability, as I do, it's even more important that you should try and remain active as much as you can. The more active you are, the healthier you'll be, and therefore you can deal with the vicissitudes of life much better. And a lot of the time, I play golf, for example. I don't actually enjoy walking. It's just too much like hard work. But somehow, I actually enjoy going and playing golf, play on the par three, nine-hole golf course at Cambridge Lakes and at Bourne and so on. And that way, I actually get really good exercise. I'm quite tired at the end of it, and I don't even realise that I actually walk quite far. So that's what I want to bring to everybody, is the idea you can actually do exercise and it can be fun and you can enjoy it. Now, golf is not for everybody, but maybe boccia is, maybe sitting volleyball, so maybe goalball. There's lots and lots of games.
Certainly is, and that aspect of fun is absolutely crucial. We spoke last week to a local tennis coach, and one of his main beliefs was making his sessions fun, and we were discussing how if you take that element out, it completely gets rid of the reason why people get involved in sport in the first place.
One of our festivals of inclusive golf, a really keen golfer, said at the end he hadn't had so much fun playing golf with us as he had in 4 or 5 years.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, just to remember that it is about fun at the end of the day.
Mm. Let's move on to some of these star names then that you got for the Oxford and Cambridge rowing sides then. British world champion Ollie Cook. There was the Rio Paralympic champion Grace Clough. Olympic triple gold medalist Pete Reed. Australian para rower Renee Domershens. And British Olympic gold medalist Tom Ransley. some really, really high profile names there in the world of rowing, John.
Yes, Pete Reed in particular was just a fantastic addition to the Oxford boat. He recently suffered a spinal stroke, so he's undergoing rehab at the moment. He thought that he would never be able to compete again, and to be given the opportunity, he jumped at it, and he's been incredibly supportive of what we do. He did it on a ski erg, which is really impressive because they're very, very hard pieces of kit to move. He pulls down from above. It's like on two straight, very large ropes, actually. And that was an amazing effort. And you can see why he was a triple Olympic champion, because he really, really goes for it. Tom Ransley, brilliant guy. Cambridge, current Olympic champion from 2016. Fantastic of him to offer up his time and energy. Grace Clough, a Paralympic champion. She's a lovely lady. She, again, not got the opportunities outside of para rowing to join in with other people. And it's that element of inclusion. A number of the rowers said, you know, there were lightweights who rowed alongside open weights, men rowing alongside women. Sophie Payne, the captain of the Cambridge crew, is just a lovely lady. And she said she'd never been in a crew in inverted commas, with such star names and men. And she just loved it. And Cambridge University Boat Club are celebrating the fact that they've come together as one club. So it's women, lightweights and men. And this helped cement it in many ways.
I say, when I look at the video, and again, we'll give the video details in just a bit, it looked brilliant, of all sort of competing against one another on the screen. And did these high-profile, high-class athletes, John, did it really give that buzz of a proper race day on the Thames? Because, of course, this year, due to the coronavirus, we didn't get the boat race on the Thames earlier this year. But I guess the virtual race has gone some way in trying to recreate that buzz.
Yes, Ollie Cookwood, the captain of the Oxford team, was very excited. And a couple of them actually admitted that they were so excited and nervous because they haven't been able to race at all, that they went off a bit fast on their rows. And they pay for it at the end of their 3 minutes row, which is quite amusing. Because actually that's really good for me, because it says it's important to them. And if it's important, they'll give everything. And they sure did. A number of them couldn't actually speak for about 2 minutes after they'd done their bits. And they were meant to wave and smile at the camera, and most of them couldn't.
Well, that leads us on nicely, John, to reveal who won. And we'll give a spoiler warning for those who want to watch it and don't want to find out the winner. That gives them enough time to quickly turn down the radio. John, who did win?
Well, I'm as a Trinity Hall Cambridge man, I'm delighted to report that it was Cambridge that just won. It was very, very close. It's a very close race. And you can go and watch it. We've been fundraising for it, and it's on our Give As You Live page. That's Power to Inspire's Give As You Live page. We've got a short link for it, and it's www.give.as/virtual boat race. And if you can't find it there, if you go to the Power to Inspire website, and that's the number 2 in the middle, you will find links and you can watch it there. But if you go through to the Give As You Live page, you can also make a donation and say well done to the Cambridge crew by donating to them.
Which I'm sure our listeners would absolutely love to do. And just to confirm the statistics as well, the men have won the last 2 boat races, the women the last 3. So they've both now won another consecutive boat race. So all good statistics as far as we're concerned, John. On to the details. And how much money did you raise, of course? Because that's what this is all about, raising money for Power to Inspire. How much did you manage to get up to in the end?
I would like to emphasise that really what it's about is promoting inclusion through sports. But it's absolutely brilliant for us because we've raised over 21,500 and it's still going. I'm really, really hopeful we'll get up to 25,000, because that will allow us to employ a part-time COO, Chief Operating Officer. I'm a volunteer. I do this full-time, unpaid, and I would like to be able to get some support so that I can do more of the work that I should be doing rather than back office stuff. So I need some help, and we would love to be able to employ somebody, and a COO would do that. So do go along and support Cambridge on the giving side, and give as you live, and that would be fantastic.
And of course, we should say, if we are catching any stray listeners from Oxfordshire, or people who are commuting to and from work, etc., then of course you can donate to the Oxford Good Crew.
And they need it, because at the moment in the fundraising states, they're a bit behind. So
there's competition there as well.
Yes, there is. Yes, so they should definitely try and close that gap.
Certainly should. Lastly then, John, will you be doing it again next year?
I'd very much like to. That's what the team want to do. It might not be, hopefully it won't be quite in the same format, because we might be able to get the eight rowers lined up on Ergs in one place. But who knows what's going to happen in a year's time, or less than a year's time. We would like to see it part of the boat race annual calendar, shall we say.
Let's certainly hope so. John, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Glad you're well as well.
Thank you very much.
Cambridge 105 Radio. Sports on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Yep, you're listening to the 105 Sports Special here on Cambridge 105 Radio. Last up this evening, let's talk St Ives Town, as last week they announced they'd appointed a new first-team assistant manager. Now, this was after former assistant Craig Adams had left the club over last weekend, and then a day later they announced the appointment of Mitch Austin, former Rothwell and Kettering man. Mitch joins me on the show alongside manager Ricky Mahinicky. Firstly, Ricky, thanks for coming on the show.
No problem, Ollie.
And also delighted to welcome onto the show for the first time, Mitch Austin. Thanks for coming on, Mitch.
You're welcome.
Let's talk football then. That's why we've got you both on. Because, Mitch, you were appointed as the first-team assistant at St Ives over the weekend. When you got the call from Ricky, was it a fairly straightforward decision to join him at St Ives, Mitch?
So we had a call probably 2-3 weeks before we was going to go as a trio, me, myself, Bully and Ricky. It was offered to me to come in as first team coach from the pair of them, and it was something that I was delighted that they offered it to me. It just, at the time, after thinking about it, it wasn't the correct move for me. I was obviously running the first team at step five, and I felt almost like to leave that position to go be ultimately a number three wasn't something that I wanted to do. Then obviously the decision for Bully to step down, and then Ricky phoned, and it was a different conversation, to be honest. It was something that I felt like I was more important in a sense, and that was not just for my ego, but for my involvement in how successful or how unsuccessful we was going to be as a club, as a team. And I don't know Ricky. I only know Ricky through friends of friends, but obviously knowing how he's brought St Ives to where they are now, it was something that I admired. So for him to offer me that, it didn't take me long to accept it, to be fair, Rick. But from when he first called, I could pretty much tell that he knew I was going to accept it. But I was like, oh, what I'll do is I'll think about it. I'll give you a week. And I thought, I was like, play the game a little.
Playing hard to get.
Yeah, you're too keen. You're just like, oh, all right. But I sensed that he knew what my position was going to be. Yeah.
And for you, Ricky, why did you opt to pick Mitch as, firstly, as like I say, the first team coach, and then when Craig left, to come in again as first team assistant?
Well, myself and Bully felt we needed help. We needed an extra person to split the responsibilities, to split the workload, to help us operate in a better way. Mitch was the person that we wanted to do that. We knew it was going to be a difficult decision for Mitch, because obviously he's predominantly been a number one throughout his whole career within football management. And to ask somebody to leave that position to come and become a third member of a coaching team, it was always going to be a tough decision. And like you said, he turned that down originally. And then when Bully said that, you know, made the decision to step down, it was quite an easy call for me. You know, like Mitch says, we don't know each other in terms of a friendship, you know, but I've certainly followed what Mitch has done in the non-league, you know, very similar to myself in many respects, from step six to step five to jumping up to Kettering in the Southern League and making the playoffs and then going returning back to step five as a number one. It's got a lot of similarities to what I did while I was at Huntingdon and then going to Histon and then jumping back to St Ives. So I know how hard it is and how hard you have to graft, and I know how difficult it is with limited resources, and I appreciate somebody that grafts that much. You know, and he has been very, very successful wherever he's been. Because like I always say, success is measured in different ways. It's not about necessarily winning titles, you know, it's money spent per point. And you know, Mitch has certainly had his hands tied behind his back in a lot of jobs. And I'm really excited. I think he'll bring some fresh ideas, a winning mentality, you know, a graft, a different sort of graft to what you find from many managers and coaches that have been at our level for a number of years. And I'm really excited as to where we can take the club. You know, there's a lot of plans going on behind the scenes to move it forward. And, you know, after last season, it needed a bit of a shake-up. It needed a freshen up. This is a perfect way, you know, although we would have been delighted to have Bully, and Bully would have still been in position had he not decided to step down. But now that the change has happened, it does feel like it's a complete fresh start, and I'm really looking forward to that. And you know, I'm really optimistic we can have a great season and try and push this club forward.
And you mentioned you tried to bring in Mitch when Craig was still at the club to create that threesome, to try and split the roles up and the responsibilities up and make, I guess, the workload slightly less. Now you've just got the two of you. Are you still happy with that makeup though, even though there is just two rather than three?
Yeah, we're, you know, myself and Mitch will predominantly be the managers, if you like. We're heavily in contact over recruitment, you know, budgets. As soon as a date is planned for the start of the season, it will be the pre-season. It will be the pre-season fixtures, the programmes. We'll be then involved in the decision-making throughout the season in terms of team selections, etc. You know, I still feel that we need a third person, and we are still trying to bring in. I think that potentially will be in a player coaching role to split the responsibilities. But yeah, I think in order for myself and Mitch to be the best that we can be, you know, myself and Buddy made the decision that we need an extra person. So I still think that is the way that we want to go with myself and Mitch.
And Mitch, you've managed in the United Counties League Prem with Rothwell, but you've also been assistant at with Kettering as well in the Southern Premier Central. So presumably you've come up against St Ives before. What have you made of them? What have you made of their players, the side, and Ricky himself?
It was how long ago would it be now, Ricky? Three years, maybe? Back end of 2 years, was it? I always remember, because at the time, Kettering was such a massive club. You know, there was so much hype around it. I didn't realise what I was actually involved in at the time. I come from being the under 21 manager and the 18s, moving straight up to be a year out with the in the UCL as like a feeder club. Went back to be Marcus's assistant, and at the time I didn't realise what the scale of the job was. So when we would go to, I don't know, St Ives, or, you know, so surrounded by this bubble of I just thought it was normal. Just doing my bit with the under 21s, I deserved to be where I was. But at the time, I realised I made a lot of mistakes, and I had to. It's only now I realise what I need to bring to the table to help Ricky to be more successful, to do my job properly. And I only remember going to St Ives once, because I was only with him for the season, and I remember it being a very rowdy place, if I'm honest. I remember the fans being really loud. I can't remember if it was a bank holiday weekend game or something like that. I hope it was, because it was very busy. Very, very busy. I just remember being... And I also remember Bully there staring me down a few times, and I thought, that's not a member of Al Shaddai's, to be honest. Probably looking over to Bully, openly gives it the, I'll be right, mate. And he's just staring down at me because we're rivals for the game. But apart from that, no, I don't really, a lot's gone on since there and now. But I'm very much looking forward to having them crowd behind us when hopefully me and Ricky are getting them 3 points.
Hopefully so. And you mentioned as well, you've sort of learnt now with regards to past experiences and what you want to bring or you can bring to St Ives. Do you know exactly what that is?
So at the time when I was at Kerin, I was predominantly just a manager. So just literally a manager. I didn't want to evolve as a coach. I was happy to bring people in as a coach, especially through like my 18s and under 21s. I felt like it was my role and my strengths was management. Well, the thing that I didn't grasp when I was Marcus Law's assistant was I wasn't the manager. And you could be very, it could be undermining to him at times if you had someone so strong and vocal that acted like a manager and didn't realise, I knew the hierarchy, but because I didn't agree with something, I would openly say it to him. And that's not the way that a number two supports a first. And that was not to be detrimental to him or anything like that, or to try to stitch him up. It was just my naivety at the time. You know, I was so focused on being a manager, and that role of number two was so different. It was so, so different, you know, and it was so hard for me to grasp that actually your vocal point has to be done between you both and not in front of any squad members. You need to back each other at all times. And don't get me wrong, it wasn't all my mistakes. There was mistakes from his part as well. And I'm sure he'd say that we was two opposite ends of people. And I felt like every time that I spoke to Ricky, and even before I accepted it, it was always somebody. And I have met Ricky a couple of times when he comes to Kerin with the game. I almost felt like he was somebody that was very, very honest. And it, from day one, I knew exactly what he wanted from me. I knew exactly what he needed. He knew about me, which again was something that I didn't feel like Ricky's here and I'm here. And for the radio, that's one hand up and one hand in the middle. You know, I didn't feel like he was ever thought that he was above me. He actually made me feel like I was, he just sold it to me. And it was almost like he needed me and he wanted me. And that was ultimately the reason why I come.
And Ricky, just before we come on to speculating about the potential new season, you said in your statement that you wanted someone you can trust. Why is that person Mitch?
I think you only need to speak to anybody that knows Mitch. I think the fact that he turned down the role with myself and Bully to be loyal to the club he was at because it wasn't quite the right role, I think spoke volumes of him as a person. He wasn't looking to try and get out or you know, move just because of the name or the level. It had to be right for him, and I like that. But I think I know a lot of people that know Mitch as well. Bully knows Mitch a lot better than I did, and Bully spoke very highly as well. And, you know, James Alger, who I was working with at Histon, a few years ago before St Ives, is very close with Mitch, and he also spoke very highly of him. So it was Mitch, just when you get to know Mitch, anyone that, you know, once you do get to know him and everyone at the club gets to know him, you will quickly realise that he's a very loyal guy. And that's more important to me than anything. You know, it's having a relationship where you can trust someone. I've been very fortunate to have Jack Cassidy. I was very fortunate to have Bully. And now, you know, I think I'm very fortunate to have Mitch. And, you know, if we can create the amount of good times that I have over the last 6 years, over the next 2, 3, 4, however long we're together, I'll be a very happy man.
We hope so as well, because that will mean St Ives are putting in some great performances on the pitch. Hopefully getting some strong results as well. And with that, of course, the speculation around the new season has been rumbling on social media. Do we have any indication at all at when you'll be able to, well, firstly, get back training and getting the group back together and preparing for the new season? And any indication at all as when that new season might start?
I've actually got no idea. You know, I've had a number of conversations with the chairman, but it's very much speculation. You know, it's, this could be one scenario, but if that there, If that doesn't happen, it could be this scenario or it could be this scenario. And each scenario that's discussed, it seems so far-fetched from the one previous. And, you know, I know that the FA have released guidelines about training and you know, as far as we're concerned, we'll continue to do our business in preparation for trying to put together a squad that we're happy with, that when they announce the season will start, we've got in place. But in terms of training, you know, I can't see us doing anything until they actually announce when we're going to come back for pre-season, simply because I don't think the players want to, if I'm being brutally honest. I think that, you know, it's still a very wary time. I think they're still sceptical as to whether they want to be travelling and training when there's professional clubs that have had their seasons cancelled a matter of days ago and they're not training. So I think as long as we do our business and put together and assemble our squad that we want for next season, we won't be looking to get them into training until the season actually starts.
And Mitch, lastly from you then, I imagine now you've joined St Ives, you're very much looking forward to that day when you can actually get on the training pitch and actually get start and get some work done.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I'm hoping there's a little week gap in between so Ricky gives me some notice so I can have a quick holiday. but yeah, I'm very much looking forward to it. I'm very much looking forward to the lads that Ricky's got there and the boys that we're looking to get in. I really can't wait to get started, and I feel like any mistakes that I did make at this level a few years back, I've learned from them, and I'm a better coach, better manager, better person to assist Ricky, and hopefully that shows on the training field and match days.
Well, we look forward to seeing the partnership blossom, if you like, over the coming weeks, and fingers crossed it's not too long before we're back seeing St Ives and both yourselves on the touchline team. Thanks very much for joining us, guys, and glad you're both well as well.
Cheers, Ollie. Take care, mate.
Thanks, bud. Cambridge 105 Radio.